All right. Let me pray to get ready, get started with this semester. Our Father, we thank you for this day. We thank you for all your blessings and for giving us this freedom, this building, and for every single person that comes here today to study, to learn in both schools. We pray your blessing on them and our minds, that you would open them to make us worshipers of you with our minds. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so now we're starting a new chapter in A Christian's Guide to the Enlightenment. We're at empiricism now, and especially this guy, John Locke. He's going to wind up introducing empiricism, similar to how Descartes introduced rationalism. What I'm going to do in four sessions, two today and two next Wednesday, is to talk about what are really the four sections of his book, Essay Concerning Human Understanding. But I'm going to divide them up, these four sections, as if they were four parts or stages on an assembly line. For the younger kids, for Descartes, we use the imagery of a house to describe the order of the rationalist thinking. Well, for the empiricists, we're going to use an assembly line. That assembly line is going to go into the brain or into the mind. We're going to describe it in detail in the second session, but just so you know, the first part on this assembly line is not something that is being produced. It's a bad product, a defective product that's being knocked off the line. And then 2, 3, and 4 will be Locke rebuilding. But just like Descartes, he's got to do some ground clearing first. And that's going to be his object of attack, this thing that he's calling innate ideas. So that's the name of this first session, Locke's Critique of Innate Ideas. And so we're going to introduce him. We're going to introduce what innate ideas are. And then we'll make an assessment of Locke's critique. So, who was John Locke? That's the first question. Well, I had this on the board for civics the other day, so I figured I'd just leave it up there. And this timeline is more geared toward Locke's political philosophy, but you can get an idea of what's going on in the 17th century. Descartes' writings are over here in the 1640s. You had, in England, the English Civil War. You had the old Catholic Arminian king beheaded. Then you had the Puritans come in under Cromwell. And in that time, you had Hobbes writing the Leviathan. We covered him last time. 1660, Charles II restores the crown. And you have the era of royal Catholic absolutism, especially in France under Louis XIV. But there's fears in England that that's going to happen too. And so you have this brief little time where everybody kind of agrees with each other to make sure James II doesn't become the king. Well, he does, but it's short-lived. In 1688, you had what was called the Glorious Revolution or the Bloodless Revolution. William and Mary from the Dutch come in, and they usher in this era of toleration. And so toleration is a big deal for John Locke and his understanding of political liberalism. We'll get to his political theory, but we need to start in his philosophical thinking. So these first four sessions are about Locke's epistemology. Remember, in philosophy, once you get to the Enlightenment, metaphysics isn't on center stage anymore. Now epistemology, how we know that we know, and you see the two schools that war against each other, rationalism and empiricism. So here's his big... all these books that couldn't be published when he actually went into exile in the 1680s in Holland, because he had during the 1660s. Well, first of all, we rewind a little bit. He was actually his parents were Puritans, so he had that background. He went to school at Westminster and Christ Church at Oxford, and actually he was studying at Oxford when John Owen was the dean there. And he wasn't very impressed by classical philosophy, and especially not by Aristotle or anything like that. And so what happened was, when he graduated, they gave him a job teaching Greek and rhetoric. His philosophy, according to the Puritans, they weren't going to let him teach philosophy. But that was his interest, philosophy, science, and ethics, political science. So he realizes he can't really have a permanent career at the university. And so what he does instead is he forms this friendship with this guy named Ashley. I can't remember his first name. But this guy becomes the Earl of Shaftesbury. And he's part of the political party called the Whigs. Well, the Whigs were against, they were the ones most, you know, they were the earliest to realize that this was all leading to a royal Catholic absolutism. So Locke gets a job instead as the personal physician of this guy, the Earl of Shaftesbury. And when he does, they have charge over the new territory in the Carolinas. So Locke, in the 1660s, writes a constitution for the Carolinas. At first, he's pretty conservative. At first, he actually writes treatises against people who express other political views. He takes that back later in life, so you see his own view kind of evolve. Well, what happens is, and this is why he goes into exile, in around 1683, in that era and there, there was a plot by the Whigs and the Earl of Shaftesbury to assassinate the king. Well, that was found out, and Locke was probably, much like Calvin in France, when there was that thing with Francis I, Locke didn't want to be implicated, and so he fled to Holland. And that's where he starts writing all these books, the Letter on Toleration, his two treatises on government, and his essay concerning human understanding. And the political ones especially, if he wrote those back in England, or if he showed up in England, he would have lost his head. So in 1688, the Glorious Revolution happens. He comes back the next year with the new queen, and it's safe to start publishing all these books. And so that's why you see that all happening in 1689 and 1690. So, but Locke represents one of four people and ideas in the 17th century that move us radically away from the medieval worldview. You've got Francis Bacon's inductivism. There was a guy who we didn't cover, but whose real claim to fame is challenging Aristotle's ultimate cause and end cause in science. You remember with Aristotle's causes, you had a primary cause, put a number one over here. You had the end cause within that, and then 2 through 4, the material cause, the formal cause, and the instrumental cause, that's what science should be looking at. Because that's the physical realm, that's the observable stuff. But what is the ultimate power behind cause, and the reason, and the design, and the end of things? Those aren't matters of science. And so Bacon was famous for extracting philosophy and metaphysics from science and just giving us a pure inductivism. So that was Bacon. Descartes' rationalism, we've already seen. Isaac Newton, his picture of the universe, gave us the idea of a closed system. And more people who were not as Christian as he was started to take that in a very naturalistic direction. Well, Locke is just the fourth piece in that puzzle in giving us empiricism. And you're going to start to see a lot of the ideas that have been famous for the last 100, 150 years that are just taken for granted come from Locke's empiricism. So, one more thing you might want to know about that, and this is just a claim I make all the time, people that are maybe not in philosophy, they just sort of either take my word for it, let it gloss over them, or just don't believe me, but either way you want to go, if you know philosophy today, and really the last generation, rationalism and empiricism are both discredited. Both lost philosophically after about 50 years during the Enlightenment. And they're certainly not respected epistemologies today. But here's the problem. If you're a secularist, they're pretty much your only avenues. And if you're a materialist, empiricism is going to capture, unless you're a math professor or just some weird aesthetic type, that, I guess you'd be both, who just loves numbers and stuff like that, but you'd be really weird if you were that and not a theist. Pretty much 99% of secularists are going to gravitate toward empiricism. So how do they reconcile that if they know it's been discredited, but they need it? Well, what they do is the same thing the devil does every generation. He just repackages an old error so that you can look at it, you see it shine with a new package, you say, well, that's different then. Good enough. I'm going with it. Maybe no one will know. And I'll just say it to myself over and over again, and maybe I won't know. Well, empiricism was repackaged in things like logical positivism at the end of the 19th century and the wider spectrum of analytical philosophy. So if you're wondering, why does empiricism, what is that even, matter today? Well, now, last, 70 years, it's just called analytical philosophy. And every once in a while, they'll come up with a new and exciting principle that they think is new and exciting, and that we'll show you when we get to David Hume. There's a principle that Hume laid out that is famously discredited, They just regurgitate it under names like the falsifiability principle and the verificationist principle. It winds up being self-contradictory, self-refuting. Okay, and the reason that keeps happening is because they keep fooling themselves and deceiving themselves that what they're believing is something new. Okay? So keep that in mind. As we go through Locke, you'll see things that you'll be like, oh yeah, that's the majority of people today that believe that. It's just taken for granted. One more interesting thing about Locke's writings before I get into this. He wrote a book in 1695 as he starts to settle in. He starts taking some. He even wrote, he died before he can finish it, commentaries on Paul's writings. So he was the original New Perspective on Paul. But he wrote a book of apologetics called The Reasonableness of Christianity in 1695, in which he defends the resurrection of Christ on evidential grounds, or the grounds that would come to be known as the evidentialist apologetic school. In other words, on the rules and on the same things that you would find admissible in a court of law, and you recognize that language from like Josh McDowell or Lee Strobel's popular books on apologetics. Well, that school of thought is called evidentialism. And Locke didn't invent it. Hugo Grotius before him could be called his father. But Locke really gets this school going among the British. And you see this dominate apologetics throughout the 18th century, leading all the way up to William Paley and his natural theology in 1801. And that's the school that Darwin, in The Origin of Species, launched his stuff against. Okay, so why does that matter? Well, Locke's empiricism is going to bring you directly to evidential apologetics. Your focus is going to be on empirical matters, whether it's science or history. That's where the game is. That's what's tangible. That's what impresses people. So there's going to be, in all of these things, whether in philosophy or civics or apologetics or theology, you're going to start to see a shift, an imperceptible shift, but a titanic shift, from the supernatural things to natural things as the most real things. Okay? So, let's get to that first part of the assembly line, and I don't want to draw it out because I want to save that for the second session. But let's suffice it to say there's an assembly line, it's going from left to right, and at the first part there's going to be a defective product, the thing that he wants to clear the ground of. And that is what he calls innate ideas. That's the first section of the essay concerning human understanding. It's actually called innate notions. And of course, notions is a synonym for ideas. And it's so annoying when they do that, because then the second section is called of ideas. And we're trying to break this down for children. And they do stuff like that. It's just totally unhelpful. But anyway, here's how he defines innate ideas, and this is my paraphrase, but I think it's a faithful paraphrase of the first couple pages. By innate ideas, we mean any impression contemplated by the mind that was impressed upon the mind from or before birth. I know yesterday I worked on a much more concise definition for the Academy Dictionary, so I can get that to you next week when I look at it, but it's pretty much any idea in the mind from birth. It was something like that that I nailed it down to. Any idea in the mind from birth. And from birth is going to be important. Whether that's from before birth, at birth, from birth, however you want to slice that up. The important point is that from the coming with the package of the human mind is this thing called an innate idea. In other words, such an impression would not simply be a capacity to reason, but the substance of a thing reasoned about. An actual idea, a principle, a law, an image of something, a category of the mind. Now, if that's all we meant by innate, namely a category of the mind, something that is in the mind, if that's all we meant, then Locke would probably have no more problem with that than any other school of philosophy would. So the key is, it's not just something that's in the mind, it's in the mind from birth. And so one of the implications, is one of the mistakes Locke makes in criticizing, is that everybody has it. It comes with the package. And so when he starts to argue against it, he argues against it on the basis of this universal consent. And that's an equivocation. All right, well, the man most famous for teaching this doctrine in the history of Western philosophy, you'd have to go back to Plato. It was in one of his dialogues, the Gorgias, in particular, that his mouthpiece and mentor, Socrates, pictured the ideal teacher as a kind of midwife to the soul, drawing forth through abstract-type questions. You know, if you read any of Plato's dialogues, Socrates is always saying things like, all right, what's the essence of justice? And then the person will proceed to list a bunch of examples. It's what I'm doing right now, and so forth. It's what all the gods agree with. And what would Socrates do? He would say, well, that's nice. Those are examples of justice. But what I'm after is what makes that thing just? What's the form of justice? How would I know the just from the unjust? And so on. These abstract questions. He's abstracting or stripping things down to its more basic essential. So what Socrates says that the teacher, the job of the teacher, is to draw forth through those questions ideas that are already present to the mind. So a midwife. Bringing out something that's by nature already there, not going against nature. Truths, ideas concerning the immaterial realm or general principles. They come into the world stamped upon the intellect. Well, there's an immediate catch to this doctrine that ought to raise antennas for the rest of our study, because Plato's version of that doctrine depended on something like reincarnation. For Plato, a lot of people think that Plato even traveled east and got the idea that the reason we have these immaterial ideas is because we've had some past life. Now, I don't think Plato's doctrine actually depends on that at all, but that is an interesting speculation. The point is that you don't have to believe anything like that to believe in something like innate ideas. But the idea was that these notions, are being recalled. They were embedded from past experience. And maybe that's what the rationalists have in mind by these clear and distinct ideas. But that's the important thing up front. When Locke is criticizing innate ideas, he has in his mind the rationalists, Descartes. But here's the problem. If you don't read carefully, or if you just pick this up secondhand through some cliff notes of Locke or something, you might get the idea that he's criticizing the medieval scholastics, which I think he was in some places, or even the Apostle Paul in Romans 1:20 or Romans 2:14 and 15. In those two places, Paul is saying that we know certain things about God through the things that have been made, and that God has written on our conscience certain moral truths. Now, somebody could shoot right back, and I think Locke would. Paul is not implying that you had to know those objects from birth. God could reveal those to you at certain points along the way, and therefore it is an immediate revelation still. Okay, we'll come back to that idea. But all I want to call your attention to right now is that Locke's main target is Descartes. The problem is he doesn't explicitly tell you that. And so if you're reading him, say for example, over the stretch of 200 plus years, people have been reading him, not caring who he's attacking, and would very much like him to be attacking the biblical idea. Which, I'm not John Locke. Maybe he was. I'm not claiming that he didn't, you know, because he had contempt for the Puritan religion of his upbringing. Okay? So, but you have to know that. He's attacking the rationalists first and foremost. So, let me ask two questions. What is John Locke's motive for refuting this doctrine? And what is his argument against it? That's kind of where we're going in this first session. Now that we've defined what an innate idea is, by the way, let me just give you examples of this. Whether it's truth, a universal like justice, numbers, form, space, time, relation. Think of Aristotle's 10 categories. Any of those things is an idea of this kind. Okay, the rationalists call them clear and distinct ideas. All right, what's his motive? Well, the basic reason that Locke wants to dispense with innate ideas is that such ideas would be beyond discussion or beyond investigation. He actually goes as far to say that this will lead to intellectual sloth and possibly intellectual intolerance. So what is Locke's big ideal, going back to his civics? By the way, your politics can come right back around and inform your epistemology. if you're so annoyed at a certain group in society, and if that group in society represents for you the oppressive regime that doesn't allow free thinking, then that's going to start to define how you understand free thought and what makes for brave and scientifically stimulating thoughts. Okay? So his main problem is that this idea of innate ideas is going to lead to something that's beyond discussion and beyond question. And you say, well, how's that? How would that lead to intolerance? Well, think about it this way. On the one hand, innate ideas are something that come with the product. You can't get away from it because it's God's design. It comes with the product of the human mind. And in addition, their unquestionable characteristic is placed within the category of authority. It's an authoritative truth. I can't get around it. So there's nothing left to question about it. By the way, you don't need innate ideas for that. People make that mistake all the time. If something is a necessary truth, that represents a wall to free inquiry. You simply take it on faith. No, I didn't take it on faith. I prove it. But it doesn't matter because if it's necessary, then it is a dogmatic truth. So you see that confusion of categories right there. It's universal. It's authoritative. It's beyond question. An idea accepted on authority and an idea impressed upon the native mind both have this one thing in common. They're ideas behind which reason will not go. We will not bother, or if we do, we'll be slapped in the wrist. So it'll lead to intellectual sloth or intellectual intolerance. That was pretty much his motive. But as I said, he's already begun to confuse primary and necessary truths with innate ideas. So here's my main problem with this section, and I'll keep coming back to this. The result of this, I don't care if Locke was not attacking Paul's doctrine. I don't care if he wasn't attacking the Puritan version of the biblical doctrine. And I don't care if he wasn't attacking the medieval scholastics. In other words, I don't care if all he was doing was criticizing the rationalists. My problem is, he should have been more clear about that everywhere and put up red flashing lights and signposts everywhere that said, when you read my book for a couple hundred years, I am not criticizing necessary truths, a priori truths, universal truths, foundational truths as such. I am only saying that they can't be in the mind from birth. Well, he didn't say that, not in a helpful way. I'm reading him with a fine-tooth comb, and I've done so a couple times, and I'm telling you, he doesn't do it clear enough. And that is going to lead to this equivocation. If necessary, therefore innate. So that when I go to the carnival and knock down the innate ideas pin, I knock down the whole house of Western philosophy and biblical revelation and sane rational thinking. Of course, nobody would say it like that. But what happens here is this equivocation, this blending together of necessary truth with innate ideas. And as you read him, you go back and forth too, and you wonder, is he going back? Does he really make this distinction? Or is he, in a passive-aggressive way, really criticizing necessary truths? He seems not to in many places. So this is what he says. He says, this is kind of more of a definition of innate ideas. It is an established opinion among some men that there are in the understanding certain innate principles, some primary notions. Primary. That is so deceptive. Primary to what? Primary in what sense? I am always, in the course of my life, coming up to primary things. 1 o'clock comes before 2 o'clock, and it does so every day. I'm not talking about my own evolution of thought. I'm talking about what is primary to something else outside of my mind. So right there. So he says, some primary notions. And then he uses the Greek for that. Koine anoia. And so koinonia is the word for communion or oneness and so on. Characters, as it were, stamped upon the mind of man, which the soul receives in its very first being and brings into the world with it. End quote. So there's a lot of questions being begged here. There's a lot of stuff he's skipping. He's simply jumbling together. If it comes first, then I learned it first. You see that? So if I say that an idea is foundational or necessary to others, I'm not talking about my starting point, i.e. the first idea I ever thought. When we talk about the laws of logic, for example, being primal, first principles in human thinking, we don't mean, and it should be obvious that we don't mean it, that a toddler's first words are mama, dada, and law of non-contradiction. And that should be obvious. Who makes this mistake? Everyone in the Enlightenment and presuppositional apologetics. What do you start with? Two separate questions. If you don't distinguish between them, you're an amateur thinker. And you're leading people to make that mistake. Okay? So very, very, very important. Primary notions. That's what I mean by innate ideas. What do you mean by that? Primary in what sense? Well, the biblically literate will immediately recognize the language of some notions being stamped upon the mind. At the very least, the conscience, as discussed by Paul in Romans 2, 14 and 15. He uses the language of written on the heart. God writes things on the heart. What do we do with that stuff written on the heart? We act out of it. I have moral knowledge that informs my moral action. Which came first? The moral knowledge came before it informed my moral action. So God is stamping something on the heart. God is impressing some truth. When does he do that? From birth at age 40? That's a separate question. So let's leave that aside right now. Are there primal and necessary truths that come first? Well, the Christian worldview and Western philosophy and all sane people everywhere, and I'm going to argue John Locke can't get away from it either, says that there is. Well, following the initial publication of the essay, Locke had been criticized on the ground that without primary ideas of some kind, there'd be nothing left of proofs of the immaterial realm. Now, he didn't care about that so much because, again, Locke is going to be an evidentialist in his apologetics. He's going to go right to the resurrection and science and things like that. He's not going to care so much about those traditional proofs for the existence of God. So, Locke disagreed with this argument. He himself was a Christian, in at least his own conception of it. But I think criticisms like this inflamed his already settled conviction that the faith that England was just coming out of was as superstitious as it was fanatical. He really saw himself as offering a more enlightened view of Christianity. And by the way, at the same time that Locke's writing these books, you have the earliest books of deistic type Christianity, sort of apologetics for deistic and universalistic kinds of Christianity. One by Matthew Tyndall, it was called Christianity as Old as Creation. And you're going to start to see the argument for the essence of Christianity being stuff that God reveals in all of nature to all people. So you see the sort of precursor to liberalism in the next century. Let me pass by some of this stuff right here. What's Locke's basic argument against innate ideas? That's his motive for attacking it. His motive for attacking it, and you already see an equivocation going on, but if intolerance and intellectual stagnation are his arguments, are his motives against innate ideas, what's the form of his argument? Well, book one is divided into two components, speculative innate ideas and practical innate ideas. As far as the speculative, Locke considers things like the law of non-contradiction and the law of identity. Since if ever there was an idea that could be considered innate, it would be ideas like that, the laws of logic. But even that won't work. His first basic argument, and it's kind of his most popular argument, is the argument that appeals to universal consent. So, remember the premise. If this comes with the package, what we're saying is that all people have innate ideas. Well, Locke offers as a counter to that three characters that he puts on the stage. One, and you have to know this when you're reading old books, words are used differently, what he calls the idiot. And he doesn't mean what we mean. He means people that are mentally disabled and so on. This is the 17th century. They didn't take sensitivity training yet. The child, and the savage, also not incredibly PC. And by savage, he just meant anybody who wasn't his friend. So it's
kind of the way we define. All right, so he brings these out and says, well, surely these people don't consent to these universal ideas. They're not clear and distinct to them. And even if it were true that everyone did agree on these things, it would still not prove that these ideas were innate. Now, at that point, now it's a pretty simple argument, but at that point the argument gets a little bit more sophisticated. Locke draws a distinction between the imprint upon the mind, that's the object, and the mind perceiving. And he concludes that we cannot have one without the other. So this is his more sophisticated argument. He draws a distinction. Here's a head. This is your brain, and this is your brain on innate ideas. So there's the subjective, let's put the actual workings of the mind right here. That's the subject. But then there's the idea itself, and it doesn't really matter what the idea is. We'll just call that one. That's the object of the idea. He's going to make a distinction between them. Good distinction. And he's basically going to say, okay, you have to... You can't have an idea without knowledge of the idea. In other words, and even if it's not accurate knowledge, you cannot have an idea that is worth calling an idea as an object without also having a thinker of the idea. Let's make up words. You can't have an idea without an idealer. An idealer. A dealer in ideas. In other words, you can't have the thought without a thinking. I think, well, that's a fair criticism. So actually, you can actually describe it in a way that's not too sophisticated. That's pretty much where his argument goes from there. If you have a form, say one or oneness, then it has to train itself upon an instance. Now he's going to make a little bit of a jump in logic. If that's true, that you can't have an idea without a thinker and an act of thought, you can't have the idea of oneness without an object, and there's the equivocation, without a one thing, one eraser, without looking at one eraser, or one piece of chalk, or so on. The universal oneness and the particular one eraser. Okay, so he makes a jump from this, which I would agree with, can't have an idea without a knower or a thinker or an active thought. An active thought is about something. Boom, right there. He just equivocated on the meaning of something. He just reduced somethingness to material particulars. You see that? He has denied without proving or giving grounds for his denial. He has just denied the ontological status of oneness. You can't have an idea without thinking. Check. I agree with that. In other words, you can't have oneness without a particular one. And right in that leap, he's denied, without ever having defended his denial, the being of universals. So clearly he's a nominalist. He's working out of that picture. So I would say, again, the victory of nominalism at the end of the Middle Ages led to even bad teachers among the Puritans, which Locke then compared that as the most high-octane version of Christianity he had. So by the time he invents empiricism, you have this caricature of realism that he's attacking. And he's not even addressing it. And I suspect he's not even addressing it because he doesn't understand the sense in which realism is really disagreeing with nominalism. All right. Well, Locke might have done a good job cornering Plato or Descartes here, but he seems unaware of Paul's explanation in Romans 1:18. There's a very good reason why certain individuals forget about the idiot, the child, and the savage. Let's just talk about a fourth person, the everyday person who hasn't thought about such things. There's a very good reason why somebody might have an idea in their mind and not start thinking about it until a certain other point. And the biblical explanation for that is sin. Now, by the way, I'm not even arguing for innate ideas right now. All I'm arguing for right now is that, see, in Locke's mind,
One of the reasons you can't have innate ideas, and it's locked up into this argument, is that what you're really saying is that everybody has the idea of everything, at least that God wanted us to have an idea of, but it only clicks at age 40 or age 14. Somebody, somewhere, something aggravates it. The idea is like awakened at that point. Or to use Socrates' imagery of the midwife, something gives birth to the idea at that moment. So you have this idea lying dormant in there and not doing anything until you came to logic class, and then we drew out the law of non-contradiction that was already in there, you know? And Locke thinks that's just absolutely silly. Well, if you say it like that, I suppose it is silly. But isn't there a biblical teaching that teaches that there are certain ideas that we have that we suppress? I mean, forget about Freud for a second and repression. Even the secularist has a category through Freudian psychology of repressing ideas. Well, Paul in Romans 1:18 talks about suppression. That we know God, but one of the reasons why he's so wrathful against us is because we suppress the truth in unrighteousness. What does that mean? That means we lock down and keep hidden and lie dormant and keep down and don't think about ideas which we really already do know about. Okay, so forget about the question of whether it comes from birth or after. It is not silly for Paul or for Freud, apparently. They agree on something. Freud's idea of repression, of course, was completely ridiculous. We didn't need him to tell us the true aspects of it anyway. The biblical explanation of it is suppression, sin. All right. An analogy from Locke's own epistemology can help here. As an empiricist, Locke does not believe that reason precedes revelation when it comes to the senses. He is, after all, a Christian of some sort. And he uses an analogy of a drawer with stuff in it. I'll get to that one a little bit later. But you could just think of something even more simple, like a toddler's eyes being dazed at the sun before you shudder. I mean, split second before, but it comes before. Much less before reason says, don't do that again. You know? So the revelation is happening first. Something is impressing itself upon the mind first. And by the way, this is going to be something where Locke, where the postmodern people don't like him either. Because he is at least agreeing with traditional Western philosophy that the mind is kind of passive here. That reality is what it is out there, and it's impressing itself on the mind. The mind is passive, at least compared to the world that is coming in this way. So in that sense, revelation is happening. You can be an empiricist like Locke and call all of those things that are stimulating our brain revelation. And many people have speculated that Jonathan Edwards was very much impressed by John Locke's philosophy and, as a theologian, just made more use of the revelation concept, but he was kind of a revelational empiricist. I think that's overblown, but certainly you can make all of those things a part of revelation, which the Bible does. Psalm 19. He says, quote, the senses at first let in particular ideas. He's going to jump ahead a little bit to the stuff we're going to talk about in our second session, but I think it's important here. The senses at first let in particular ideas and furnish the yet empty cabinet. So this is his analogy. It's a little bit tougher. Our brains are like empty cabinets and they're being furnished with ideas. So ideas are being set up as furniture in an otherwise empty room. And the mind by degrees, growing familiar with some of them, they are lodged in the memory, and names got to them. So memory and words come after this. The senses are first. Afterwards, the mind proceeding further abstracts them, and by degrees learns the ordinary names. So Locke just gave you a blueprint with this imagery of the cabinet, or what did he say, call it? Yeah, the empty cabinet and the furniture. Cabinet, such a, they spoke so differently. Just think of it as a room, an empty room, and furniture. Okay? So it's being furnished, first of all, with sense impressions. The ones that are strong form memories. The ones that really linger and that really impress themselves upon it, we give names to those. And then we graduate to knowledge. What he just did is he gave you the points on his assembly line that are going to form the whole four books of his book. I'll skip past that. skip past that. You kind of get the idea already what it is. So let me just offer a criticism beyond what I've already said. And I'll probably be repeating some things that I already said. Locke, in the beginning of his book, gives us a threefold aim of his book. What does he want to do? He says his goal in the essay was to inquire into the original certainty and extent of human knowledge. So let's use that first word first. The original. In other words, he means the origin. What is the origin of human thought? Well, remember, once this straw man slash equivocation happens, the foundation, what's the foundation of your thinking? What started to happen, and it was already happening before Locke, was the question of epistemology was shifting right from its beginning. Epistemology is supposed to be about truth criteria. How do you know? And when I say how do you know, I'm not talking about cognitive science. I'm not asking you for your own little intellectual journey. I'm not asking you for anything subjective. I mean, how do you know that you know? In other words, I'm after something more like a ruler than something in your own head. What's the standard? Is there a truth that stands over all of us by which we measure the truth or falsity of other truths? That's what I'm after. When I say foundation, when I say universal truth or antecedent truth or a priori truth or axiom or first principle, when I use words like that, I don't care whether you got it when you were a baby or when you were 40. So what Locke's doing is he's joining a wave that's already underway in the Enlightenment. We saw it in Descartes. There's a turning inward. There's an inward turn of epistemology. The epistemological question becomes entirely subjective. And when Locke starts to criticize innate ideas, and when other people reading him start to criticize the foundations of thinking, they have in their mind, by origin, what I'm going to call a natural history of knowledge. The question is only ever allowed to mean, when did you start? What did you start with? What do they start with? The natural history of knowledge. It's a natural account of the history of a thought process in the subject, in the individual mind. So when anybody from any school after the Enlightenment tends to think about first thoughts, primary truths, the foundation, when you say that, all people are trained to hear is, when did you start? What did you start with? What did I start with? What did they start with? That is an irrelevant, subjective, emotionalist question. The question should be about objective starting point. It, outside of us all. What must be true for other things to be true, even if no one got it? So Paul goes on to say in Romans, in chapter 3, verse 4, let God be true, though everyone were a liar. Objective epistemology was shot in the foot right out of the gates in the Enlightenment. So he begins by assuming this natural history of knowledge. And he writes as if innate ideas and necessary truths could be blended together. He at least is not careful to make it clear that he's only attacking the rationalists. But when classical man, whether it was a pagan or a Christian, when classical philosophy spoke of one idea being foundational for another, one idea being necessary for another, they had in mind that the one thing was necessary to be in order for the other thing to be. It didn't matter who got it or what you felt about it. It had nothing whatsoever to do with when each concept happened to present itself to an individual mind. Locke ignores this distinction up front, and then he proceeds to knock down the whole house of a priori concepts in a house of straw called innate ideas. I do have some evidence in here that he was for certain necessary truths, and I think it's fair enough just to point that out and not get into that whole section. He's going to agree with Hobbes on some things. which we talked about last time. But let me just stop there and open it up to questions, and then we'll do the second session.